Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review bring you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the numbers don't add up when we come back. You know, Charles Lyell, he was one of the modern pillars of geology. He published his Principles of Geology back in the 1800s. His concepts are so widely accepted today that most of the people that believe him don't even know who it was that originated those ideas to start with. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins was devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes back through time indefinitely. That way, catastrophes like Noah's flood or a Mount St. Helens are strictly ruled out, and this process is called science. Well, listen to this. Speaking of erosion, consider the present rate of erosion tearing down the world's land mass right now and then filling into all of the oceans. The indications of continental geography show that the past rates of erosion have been much greater than they are today. But even so, at present rates of erosion around the world, there would have or should have accumulated at least 30 times more sediment in the ocean than there actually is today. Now, of course, this is based on the assumption that the ocean has been there for at least 1 billion years. 1 billion years. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the dinosaurs and their extinction? Remember, that was 65 million years ago. And yet, when we look at the amount of sediment in the oceans would have to have been there for 1 billion years. A billion years, that's what they're telling us. And there should be 30 times more sediment in it, and it isn't there. Now that tells you that the ocean hasn't been there for 1 billion years. Doesn't it? You know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the math on these kinds of pseudoscientific lies, and that's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda that masquerades under the guise of science. And it's one more of the many lessons that we teach here at the law school on the Mosaic Law. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first. That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. And it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. And you can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, I have said it before, I'm going to say it again. The numbers just don't add up. As a businessman, oftentimes someone will come into my office and they will say to me, "I've got this real neat deal, Gordon, and I'd like to pitch it to you." And I say, "Well, lay it on me." And the guy will sit there and he'll lay out a plan. He'll say, "Well, I'd like to buy this piece of real estate over here, and here are the pictures of it, and it's a real dog, but if we were to paint the house and to put in new carpet and renovate it, why, it would be worth this amount of money, and then it'll only cost this amount of money to fix it, and we'll have a profit of." Well, when you get to be an old man, you become a lot more skeptical of a proposal that's being made in your office because you know from past experience that it's exaggerated. It isn't that there isn't a profit there. It isn't that it isn't a good deal. It's that The good deal is being exaggerated into a spectacular deal at the presentation. And oftentimes people may not intend to do this, but they embellish the good points and then they overlook the bad points. You know, for instance, you might ask a question, have you had a termite inspection? Well, no, I haven't. Well, if you haven't had a termite inspection, then the house might be full of termites. Well, it doesn't look like it's full of termites. When was the last time you saw a sign in the front yard, this house is full of termites? You know, boys and girls, you don't know whether a house has got termites in it until you've got a termite man that goes out there and pokes around a little bit. And he either finds termites or he doesn't, or he finds a few but not too many, or, you know. But I start asking probing questions, you know, like, what's the roof like? Well, the roof looks good. Does it leak? Well, I don't know. I don't think so. Has it rained in the last 6 weeks? No. So we won't know whether the roof leaks until it rains again. Have you been up on the roof to inspect it? Well, no. You see, what happens here is we get a report. The guy's making a proposition to you, but he really hasn't done his homework. The numbers don't add up. And so when you put the numbers to this and you start crunching the numbers, you find out that the numbers don't add up. Now, I've brought this to your attention two or three times, and in the opening here today, I pointed out that the erosion that's going on in the world today, this is their story. It's not my story. My story is Genesis 1 is correct, that the earth was created in 6 24-hour days. Not 6,000 years, but 6 24-hour days. And that it's a sudden creation. It's young. It's only been here for 6,000 years. You know, 6,000 years is a long period of time to you and me. But when you compare 6,000 years to a billion years or 4 billion years or 15 billion years when the Big Bang occurred, that's a drop in the bucket. 6,000 years is a very young Earth. And the evidence that we see is, and I pointed this out to you the other day, that when you look at Mount Everest is a tall, newly formed, still being formed, rugged mountain. Now, if you looked at the rates of erosion going on around the world today, in 14 million years, the world would be worn down smooth as a billiard ball. If you leveled out all of the land masses in the world and you filled in all of the holes in the Mariana Trench and in the Atlantic Trench and so on, there's enough water in the world to bury all of the land on planet Earth under 10,000 feet of water. I mean, if you leveled everything out and then put the water on top of it, you'd have 2 miles of water. Well, over time, just based upon what we're observing today, billions of years, that's exactly what's going to happen. But when we take a look at the numbers, I pointed this out the other day, if you all remember, it would only take 14 million years, 14 million, spelled with an M, 14 million years, at today's rate of erosion, to wear all of the land mass down to sea level. Now, the evolutionists tell us that the world has been here for many, many, many millions of years. They're the guys that came up with the uniformitarian story, the Charles Lyell uniformitarianism. Here's what uniformitarianism is. They tell us that what's going on in the Grand Canyon has been going on there for millions and millions of years. Okay? So I come along and say, well, let's crunch the numbers. Just crunch the numbers. The Colorado River runs through the Grand Canyon today, and they measure how much it's eroding. And the answer is it's about 1 inch every century. So that river running through the canyon is carving out 1 inch every 100 years. Well, there's 12 inches in a foot, and from the top of the canyon there at the north rim, it's 5,400 feet down to the bottom. So I took 5,400 feet, And I multiplied that times 12, and that tells us how many inches there are. And then I multiplied that times 100, and that tells me that there's 6,480,000 years that that canyon has been in the making. Now, that fits right into the evolutionary story, doesn't it? They tell us that it's been going on there for millions and millions of years. All right? So, I take a look at that and I say, well, those numbers add up. Now, let's take a look at the size of the canyon. If you've ever been to the Grand Canyon, it's 11 miles across. 11 miles. Where it's wearing out that 1 inch every century is down in the river channel. So it doesn't answer our question, well, what about the other 11 miles across there? The river is maybe 200 feet across, 300 feet, max 300 feet across. So it's wearing out a channel down there today, but you know there's side channels that are miles and miles long that are off to the sides. And there's no water in those today, none at all. They're just dry. Which indicates that a long time ago there was water running through there, and it's pretty obvious that the Grand Canyon is made by water. So when we take a look at the Grand Canyon, it's made by water. How about a giant worldwide flood like you saw up at Mount St. Helens on the Tuttle River? Now, that adds up, and that makes sense, but what you're looking at today doesn't add up, and it doesn't make sense. That's my point. So when I say the numbers, you know, the devil's in the details, when you start crunching the numbers don't add up. I pointed out to you the other day, for instance, on the sun, you've got these astrophysicists, you know, getting paid by the government. And the astrophysicists, they all come along and they tell us, well, the sun is shrinking. Well, how much is it shrinking? Well, it's 5 feet an hour. How do we know that? Well, that's what the scientists tell us. I don't know how fast it's shrinking. I haven't got a clue. So I take the report from the government scientist, and he's been looking at this. It's the English that have been doing the most work on it. For the last 300 years, they've been watching the sun. They've been taking measurements. They've been taking photographs. They've done everything that they can. Now they come up with a report here in 1980. And they said, well, now we've got the numbers. We've got all the evidence. The sun is shrinking at the rate of 5 feet an hour. So I went ahead and I did the arithmetic. And then when you do the arithmetic, you find out that 20 million years ago, if the sun is shrinking at 5 feet an hour, then that means that the sun was bigger yesterday than it is today. That means that the sun was bigger a year ago than it is today. Well, it's 750,000 miles in diameter today. About 750,000 miles. So if we just add 5 feet an hour to that and we start going back billions and billions of years, which they tell us that what we're seeing today has been going on forever, that these catastrophes spoken of in the Bible, like Noah's flood, are fairy tales. That's what they tell us. It's just a damn fairy tale. Don't believe that. Okay. So let's believe this scientist now. He says the sun is shrinking by 5 feet an hour. Why isn't that a fairy tale? Well, that's science. What evidence do we have? I haven't seen any evidence. All I know is what they're telling me. So I'm going to come along and tell you, well, okay, let's believe them. It's their story, and their story is that it's burning up at the rate of 5 feet an hour. Well, I'm a businessman, so I get my trusty Sharpie EL1197 out here, and I start doing some crunching of numbers, and I find out that 20 million years ago, at that rate, the sun would have been 93 million miles in diameter. Now, it just so happens that the Earth has an orbit around the sun. And that just happens to be 93 million miles from planet Earth to the sun. So I say to myself, okay, well then, 20 million years ago, the sun was 93 million miles in diameter. Now here's the problem with that. 65 million years ago, there were dinosaurs on the planet that were snuffed out by a comet. See where we're going with this story? So I'm sitting here in my office. I'm listening to this guy make me the pitch. He says, what you see going on today, Mr. Gordon, has been going on for billions and billions of years. And I said, oh, I didn't know that. Tell me more. And he says, yeah, and 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs died out. Oh, I didn't know that. Tell me more. And he goes on and he tells me the sun is shrinking at the rate of 5 feet an hour. Jeez, I didn't know that. Tell me more. And I says, well, that's a story. It's called evolution, and you should believe that. And the Bible is a total fiction, and you shouldn't believe the Bible. And so I crunch the numbers, and I find out, well, there were dinosaurs on planet Earth 65 million years ago, but 20 million years ago, the sun was 93 million miles in diameter, which means that there wouldn't have been any sun or Earth revolving around the sun to start with. There wouldn't be any Venus. There wouldn't be any Mercury. But we have Mercury, and we have Venus, and we have the Earth here today. The numbers don't add up, son. Why don't you go back, crunch your numbers again, and come back and make a presentation when it adds up? Now, that's the story on the numbers. I told you about the Niagara Falls. Niagara Falls, you know, that water running over the lip of the falls, it breaks off the rock there. And it's been doing that, I guess, for a long time. Longer than you and I have been around. So we got people called geologists, and they go out there to the Niagara Falls, and they watch these rocks breaking off, you know, off the cliff there, and they measure that back. And they've been measuring that back now for 100 years or 150 years, and every year it breaks off about 2 or 3 feet. Now, when I went to the falls, I didn't see any rocks breaking off there. I just saw all this water running over, but, you know, that's what they're telling us. And if they're telling us the truth, and I suppose they are, I don't have any reason to believe that they're lying to me, per se. So the falls are wearing back at the rate of 2 to 3 feet a year. Well, then, that means that last year the falls were closer to the lake than they are today, and 2 years ago they were 6 foot closer, and 3 years ago was 9 foot closer. And, well, then, if this has been going on for millions and millions and billions of years, and what we're observing here at Niagara Falls has been going on uninterrupted through the process of uniformitarianism for millions and millions and billions of years, well, then we ought to be able to add 2 feet a year to that number, and that should take us out to where the falls began. But you know, we can drive about 5 or 6 miles down to where the falls began, and you can see where the thing started. And then where it's worn back to, and then you take the number of feet that it's wearing back every year, and you crunch the numbers, and you find out that it turns out to about 5,000 years, which is about where Noah's flood occurred, 4,300 years ago. Now, the Noah flood story and Genesis chapter 1, 2, 3, and Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9 add up. They fit into the numbers that we can observe today. The evolutionary story doesn't fit in. Again, the devil is in the details. Now, I'm not a great mathematician. You know, my name isn't Hawking. I don't sit here and pretend, you know, that I'm a great theoretical physicist or something, but I can do a few simple calculations. I can figure out what the profit margin is, you know, on an investment. I can figure out what the rate of inflation is. I can follow the M1, the M2, and the M3 money supply story, and, you know, I'm just an average Joe Sixpack. But when I do the arithmetic over here, kids, I find out that, hey, this story doesn't add up. This evolutionary story over here, when you put the numbers to it, is a lie. Now, a misstatement is where you make a statement and you've made an error. You didn't make the misstatement intentionally. It was an accident. But when you come into somebody's office and you give them numbers that you know are false, that's a lie. And you're doing that with motivation. And these evolutionists today, when they write books and they tell us these stories, these people are educated people. They've been to college. They've got letters after their names. They're authors. In many cases, they're academians. I mean, they're professors in Yale and Harvard, and they write books and tell us stories, sell those books to us. They write articles for the National Geographic magazine, things like that. And so the reason that I thought I would bring this story to you is because the Jehovah's Witnesses, as lowly and as hated and as despised as they are, I mean, nobody likes a JW coming up knocking on their door, do they? I guess some people do, but most people don't. And religion in general is hooted and jeered and scoffed at, you know, and probably with good cause. I think that the evolutionists, you know, have got a good point. When they take a look at Roman Catholicism and Christianity in general, and at the Inquisitions, and at the evil, and the wickedness, and the duplicity, the hypocrisy of religion, and the contradictions of religion. I mean, you got here in this in the United States, we got 476 incorporated denominations and sects and groups of people that call themselves churches. 476. They all tell a different story. And they all claim to get their information out of the same source, the Bible. You know, you don't have to be a mathematician, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that these religions over here, if any one of them's right, the other 475 of them are wrong or in error to some degree, if one of them is totally correct, because all 476 of them disagree. I've mentioned this before, all 476 of them could be in error, and there could be a 477th answer that has the truth. Has anybody ever thought of that? I have, and I contend that the Bible has the truth and the 476 religions are all in error. And those religions that follow some of the principles or some of the biblical instruction probably have a little bit of truth. Probably all of them have a little bit of truth mixed with a little bit or maybe a whole lot of error, which then gives us in the final analysis an error. Let me give you an illustration. Guy walks into my office and he wants to make a presentation. So he makes a presentation. And so we start going over the numbers. And I say, well, what about this number here? You say that the purchase price of the house is $50,000. And he says, yeah, that's right. But I said, looking here at the purchase contract, it says the down payment's 10%. And the down payment over here is $20,000. Now, either one, the purchase price is $100,000 and 10% is this amount, or else it's $50,000 and the down payment is $5,000. So is the down payment $5,000 on a $50,000 transaction, or is the down payment $10,000 on a $20,000 transaction? Or what is this? Oh, well, I made that mistake. Okay. Well, if you made a mistake there, then all of the numbers that you're in here making your presentation are now all of a sudden suspect. Now, is this a phonied up presentation, or is this just a mathematical error? I don't know, but now we got to check all the numbers, don't we? I mean, either this guy can't add and subtract. You see, the way we work out here in the real world, you know, when we listen to 10, 15, 20 facts, we don't go out here and check every particular fact. We check three or four or five facts. And if we, as we're checking this fact and that fact and the next fact and the next, if all of them are correct, we presume that all the other facts that we didn't check are true. But as soon as we find one error, then we have to presume, well, gosh, if we found an error here, there might be a second or a third error or a fourth error. Now we got to check all 20 of our facts. You know, when we're trying to get a TV rating out here and find out how many people are watching this show, we do this quite often here. You know, we want to know how many people out there in radio land listen to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. So do we go out here and knock on everybody's door, you know, like a religious guy, and say, what radio station are you listening to right now? First of all, it's physically impossible. Secondly, we haven't got enough money to do that. And so we got to have some better way of coming to a conclusion. So we have an outfit called Arbitron. And you call Arbitron, you say, well, how many people are listening to Rush Limbaugh? And so the Arbitron people go out and they do a sampling. And they sample 1,500 houses across the country. Because they have a science here that's called statistics. And so they figure that 1,500, you know, you go out to California and you take a few out of California and a few from North Dakota and so on. You take some from the city and you take some from the country. You take some from the suburbs and you take some from the slums. And, you gotta spread it around. And then you go out and at a specific time, you know, at 10 o'clock on Wednesday, nor when Rush Limbaugh is on, you know, it's at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And you send out your 1,500 surveyors and they all go out and knock on somebody's door. We're actually a little more sophisticated than that. We got radio equipment that'll do that for us, but just follow along here. Then you'll find that there's a certain percentage of those 1,500 people that are listening to Rush Limbaugh. And so you take that percentage and then you go to the Census Department and you say, well, we know that there's 300 million people that live in the country. So we took 1,500 people as a sampling across the country from all walks of life, and here's how many out of 1,500 are listening to Rush Limbaugh. And so therefore we'll extrapolate that into the whole 300 million people, and that'll tell us in our own round pretty accurate numbers, you know, plus or minus a percentage point or two, as to what the listening audience is. We can do that. You know, we can use math to come to the conclusion that evolution is a fairy tale. Because the numbers don't add up. It isn't that the numbers don't add up in one or two cases. Boys and girls, the numbers don't add up in a single case presented by evolution in the last 200 years. I have never seen a single case where the numbers, when we actually did the arithmetic, come out. Now, you know, if you come into my office, I can't speak for everybody, you come into my office and make a presentation to me, and you've got numbers that don't add up, I'm going to tell you, go back and do your homework, and then come back and make your presentation. The evolutionists here have not done their homework. You've got one group of evolutionists that are looking at the sun come up with some numbers. You got another group of evolutionists. They're out here looking at the Mississippi River and the sediments. You got another group of evolutionists. They're measuring the Grand Canyon and the erosion going on in the bottom of the canyon. Then you've got biologists, you know, all these disciplines that are out here, and they've all got a story to tell. Then when you compare their stories, they don't add up. That's my point. Now, if you want to believe their story, that's your choice in life. Hell, I'm not here to tell you what to believe. I'm here to make a report, and that's my report. And by the way, I'm getting this report out of a book here that's put out by the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of Pennsylvania. They put out 18,800,000 copies up through 1985. I thought that was pretty impressive. And I checked their numbers in here, and I read their book. It's 255 pages, and it checks out. And that's why I made the report. And we try to be as accurate as we can here. Every once in a while we make a mistake. Somebody will call me up, and they'll say, hey, Gordon, you know, that number you gave us over there was in error. It happened. I never said that I was the Pope. I never said I was infallible. I just said I'm pretty good, you know, we try to check our numbers here. And once in a while I'm working on my little calculator over here and I'm trying to keep my place in the book and I'm trying to watch my clock here on the radio time and I'm trying to juggle three balls here at the same time and I make an error and I give you a wrong number. I can assure you that it's inadvertent when I do it, and when I find that out, I try to correct it and write you a letter back and say, hey, you know, you're right. and I'm sorry that I made that mistake. But it happens once in a while. Now, if evolution made a mistake once in a while, you know, we'd say, well, okay, you know, we're not claiming that every detail that went on over the last, you know, 2 or 3 billion years has to be an exact time order. But we would expect that when we're talking about evolution, and we're telling people that this occurred over billions and billions of years, you know, let's just take a look at the life forms. The life spontaneously generated on the planet, we're told, about 3 billion years ago. Boys and girls, 20 million years ago, the sun would have been 93 million miles in diameter, following this same line of reasoning called uniformitarianism. So either uniformitarianism isn't true, or the sun hasn't always been burning at the rate of 5 feet, which tells us that, well, maybe at some time in the past it was burning 10 feet an hour, and maybe at some point in the past it was burning 1 inch an hour. Maybe at some point in the past it wasn't burning very much at all. We don't know. Well, in that case, then we can't use uniformitarianism at all. That takes us back to, well, how do you explain the Grand Canyon? Well, from time to time there are catastrophes, like Noah's Flood, like Mount St. Helens, like Mount Rainier. Disasters do occur, like a tsunami over in the Indian Ocean that kills 500,000 people, or 250,000, however many it was over there, and wipes out whole cities at a time. Things like that happen. Those are catastrophes. And when those catastrophes occur, it changes the landscape. That's not evolution. That's catastrophe. That's what the Bible talks about, catastrophe. All right. I got to give you a reminder here if I can find my papers. We're at the halfway point, and this is the Law Hour and Editorial Review. And we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on the website. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed to the website as well. And the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. And we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, they're accurate and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. But these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors and publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour, they may be political or hostile or religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the fossil record. We're talking about evolution. We're talking about the universe. We're talking about the size of the sun, erosion, Niagara Falls. We're putting a composite story together from a book called Life, How Did It Get Here by Evolution or by Creation, put out by the Jehovah's Witnesses. And the thing that caught my attention, I said, my God, they put out 18 million copies of this book. I mean, this is like a bestseller's bestseller's bestseller. I mean, you know, if you're selling a million copies of a book, you're talking about this Harry Potter. I'm not sure that woman has sold 18 million of those Harry Potter books total. Now, she might have. It might be more than that. It seems to me like it may be second. I think that Harry Potter series is second only to the Bible. Now, there's been hundreds of millions of copies of the Bible printed over the years. There's a bunch of those. But, you know, when you're talking about putting out 20 million books, that's a bunch. Now, it may be true that these people have bought and paid for these books and they gave them away free. And therefore, they're not very popular. I can't tell you how popular they are, but somebody sent me this book. I don't know where it came from. Oftentimes, people send me material that's totally unsolicited, and it goes into my pile. I got a big pile over here behind my desk, and when it comes in the mail, I put it on my pile, and every once in a while, I go through that pile, and I sort out the wheat from the chaff. And I saw this book, and I thought, Life, How Did It Begin Here? Another evolution book. And so I took a look at the couple, three chapters in the table of contents, and then I read a chapter, and then I read two chapters. There's 20 chapters in the book, and I finished it up, and I said, hey, these guys got their act together. I mean, this is a whale of a good story, and it's written in layman's language so that you and I can understand it. That's the thing I liked about it, and I get a lot of books in here, and I've got a lot on my shelf over here. There's a terrific book called The Genesis Flood. If you want the straight skinny from science on the biblical account of the flood and how scientific it is, it's written by Whitcomb and Morris, still in print, first published in 1963. It's still in print. You can probably get it at your local Bible bookstore. My complaint about it was that you need a dictionary to read it. You know, unless you're smart. You know, and I never claimed to be the sharpest marble in the drawer, but, you know, I can read, you know, fair to middling well, but I needed a dictionary. I took the first two or three chapters with a dictionary, and then as I was going through the book, I'd write in layman's language, you know, like an idiocentric geosyncline. What the hell is a geosyncline? I don't know. So you look it up, and you know, oh, I see. Then. Or geology, what is it? Well, it's earth study. And so then you write in every place that says geology or geosyncline, you write in the layman's term here, you know, so we can understand it. You could write a book, you know, so that it can be understood by the average guy on the street. You can do that. But people that write books don't do that. If there is a simple word, they'll go to a thesaurus and find a word that nobody has ever heard before. Like facetious. You know, I remember the first time I heard that word facetious. Now, you know, the average plumber out on the job doesn't say, Bob, are you trying to be facetious? You know, hey, Bob, you trying to be funny? Hey, Bob, you pulling my leg? You know, would be a more logical term to use. And so, you know, they use these words trying to show us how smart they are. And I think in the final analysis, the reason I don't read many of their books is because I can't understand them. And I don't want to have to sit here and read a book, you know, with a dictionary in one hand and a book in the other. So this is a book that everybody can read, and it's scientifically accurate. That's what I like about it. See, the Bible is a simple book to read. There isn't anything in the Bible that's difficult for you to read. Now, you may not know what it means, but it's, you know, it's written in layman's terms. In fact, the creation account in Genesis 1, 2, and 3 is written in simple terms that if you're a farmer in Indonesia, you could read that story and you'd understand it. The people that don't understand it and lie about it are the people that go to college and have PhDs after their names. And they're the guys that can't grasp it because the language is too simple. Now, there are these huge gulfs. The question is, can evolution bridge them? Well, fossils have tangible evidence of the varieties of life that existed long before man's arrival, but they have not produced the expected backing for the evolutionary view of how life began or how new kinds of life got started thereafter. Now, commenting on the lack of transitional fossils to bridge the biological gaps, Francis Hutching made this observation. He said, "The curious thing is that there is a consistency about the fossil gaps. The fossils go missing in all of the important places." I'm going to underline that line there. The fossils go missing in all of the important places. You know, we were assured that when we looked into this, when they made the presentation here in our office, that, you know, the fossil record would have all of these intermediate species. You know, the fish as it was developing its fin into an arm and a hand and a wrist and fingers, that we would find intermediate species over here. In fact, there should be 10 times more intermediate species than there are final products. Because before you got to the hand with four fingers and an opposing thumb, you started out with a fish's fin. Remember, Mr. Evolutionist? All right. So there has to be, you know, a 10% fin. I mean, a 10% hand on a 90% fin, and then an 80% fin with a 20% hand, and so on down the line until we finally come to a hand. And there isn't any of that. There are 100% perfect fins and 100% perfect hands found all over the fossil record that appear suddenly, and they're all there, and they all work perfectly, just like that woodpecker's tongue. Just works like a shot. But when you start looking at the, you know, we're looking for a woodpecker over here. Yesterday I told you about 10 things this woodpecker's got to have in order to make that tongue and make that woodpecker a viable critter out here in the environment. And he's got them today. He's got all those 10 things, and he has to have all 10 of them or he doesn't work. So how did they develop? Well, one guy comes into my office and he said, "Well, Mr. Gordon, they all evolved." I say, "Lay it on me." And he tells me the story, and I say, "Wow, that's pretty good. Let's start looking at the numbers and let's start asking some hard questions." And his story falls apart. And so I just say to the evolution guy, "Well, why don't you go back to your drawing boards and get your story straight? Get that sun thing straightened out, that 5 feet, you know. And then get that 65 million year thing straightened out with the extinction of the dinosaurs. And then get that Niagara Falls thing straightened out, and get that sediment on the floor straightened out, and get that erosion thing straightened out, and get that Grand Canyon thing straightened out, and then come back and make your presentation and see if it makes sense." Now, evidently, like religion, you know, you're supposed to just believe it. I don't just believe religion, and I just don't believe evolution, because their numbers don't add up. Religion doesn't add up. Evolution doesn't add up. Now, the Bible adds up. I can go through the Bible. I can add that one up, and it makes sense, and it's scientific, and we can duplicate it in the laboratory. Now, I can't duplicate religion in the laboratory. I can't duplicate evolution in the laboratory, but I can duplicate the Bible in the laboratory. So that's why I said, you know, there's a 477th answer out there. The important places he refers to are the gaps between the major divisions of animal life. An example of this is that fish are thought to have evolved from the invertebrates, creatures without a backbone. But fish jump into the fossil record, Hitching says, seemingly from nowhere, mysteriously, suddenly, full-formed. Well, boys and girls, that's precisely what Genesis chapter 1 tells you. And the Lord said, let the waters bring forth, and the waters brought forth, and there they all are, all perfectly formed with backbones and fins. They just work like a shot. Those fish are perfectly adapted for their environment. They don't do well on land. You know, when you pull that fish into the boat, he doesn't do well in that boat at all. Throw him back in the water, he does fine. Take him out of the water, he doesn't do good. Now, zoologist N.J. Burrell comments on his own evolutionary explanation of how the fish arrived by saying, in a sense, this account is science fiction. Science fiction. No, no. Science fiction actually makes sense. You know, when Jules Verne wrote 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, he did that back in about 1880. Now, a couple of submarines had been created here in the Civil War. In fact, I think there was even a submarine or two back in the Revolutionary War. You know, hand-powered and one thing and another. They didn't work very well, but, you know. And then we had these ironclads, you know. And then Jules Verne, he takes submarine and ironclad, and then he takes nuclear energy off the sun. He looks up at the sun, I guess, and he said, if we could duplicate that energy on the sun here on planet Earth and put that in some kind of a vessel, like a steam engine, and then put that in a submarine, and he wrote this book called 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. 1955, I think, was the year they launched the Nautilus, the first atomic-powered submarine. Now, Jules Verne had some legitimate logical concepts. Could you make a submarine? Well, we hadn't done a very good job up to 1880, but in theory, you know, yeah, we could do that. And maybe as technology grows, maybe we'll be able to make a submarine. And in theory, we ought to be able to capture the energy of the sun and duplicate it here. We call that nuclear energy today, and we have accomplished that. Boys and girls, evolution doesn't even rise to the level of science fiction. Jules Verne's numbers came out. He didn't come up with a submarine, you know, that was 36 feet long or 3,000 feet long. He came up with a submarine that was probably 300 feet long. Small and cramped, but, you know, big enough. He came up with the idea of a diving bell that, yeah, you could open it up. You know, when they escape from a submarine, they flood a hatch. They've got diving lungs, you know, scuba gear, you know. And he came up with the idea of scuba gear, carrying your oxygen with you. In 1880, that was science fiction. But it was reasonable and it was logical. It's just that it hadn't been done yet. So the same thing, I remember when I was a kid, they used to have a comic strip called Flash Gordon, and he was in a spaceship and traveling around out there in space. Now, we've duplicated that. That's science fiction in 1930, but, you know, in 1990, you know, it's pretty much accomplished fact. It's science. What is science fiction, or what is totally inane, is Carl Sagan say, we're going out into the cosmos and colonize it. Boys and girls, the closest star is 7,000 light years away. You know, we only live for 70 years. 70. And that's assuming we could travel at the speed of light, which isn't very logical. But, you know, in theory, we could get going faster than 25,000 miles an hour. But, you know, in the realm of physics, you know, when you're out here talking about the speed of light and you're talking about friction and so on, you know, you're at a point where that's no longer science fiction. You know, we're talking about religion now. Religion is a subject matter over here that doesn't have any rhyme or reason to it. Evolution doesn't have any rhyme or reason. They teach it as a dogma, you know, just like religion. They teach evolution in public school just like they teach religion down here at your local church. Doesn't have any rhyme or reason to it. You can't duplicate it in the laboratory. What you see in the Bible, you can duplicate in the laboratory. What you see here in church, you can't. Now, evolutionary theory presumes that fish became amphibians, and some of these amphibians became reptiles. And from the reptiles came both the mammals and the birds, and eventually some mammals became men. The previous chapter has shown that the fossil record does not support these claims. This chapter will concentrate on the magnitude of the assumed transitional steps, and as you read on, consider the likelihood of such changes happening spontaneously by undirected chance. So they start off here. Let's take a look at the gulf between fish and amphibians. It was the backbone that distinguished the fish from the invertebrates. This backbone would have to have had to undergo major modifications for the fish to become amphibian. That is, a creature that could live both in the water and on land. A pelvis had to be added, but there are no fossil fish that show how the pelvis of amphibians developed. In some amphibians, such as frogs and toads, the entire backbone would have had to change beyond recognition. And also skull bones are different. In addition, in the forming of amphibians, evolution requires fish fins to become jointed limbs with wrists and toes, accompanied by major alterations in muscles and nerves. Gills must change to lungs. In fish, blood is pumped by a two-chambered heart, but in amphibians, it's a three-chambered heart. In mammals, it's a four-chambered heart. We don't have any hearts, boys and girls, that are evolving from 2 to 3 to 4. I mean, surely, you know, somewhere out there we ought to have some animals running around today that are in the process of evolving into something. There's no evolution going on around you today. The woodpecker is perfectly formed and fits right in to his environment. Boys and girls, man today is perfectly formed, fits right into his environment. We work perfectly. In fact, there is a psalm that says, you know, fearfully and wonderfully made are we, the humans. Fearfully and wonderfully made. Your heart works perfectly. You're not in pain all the time unless you induce it yourself. I mean, there are people out there, you know, that have migraine headaches and they've got, they wear glasses and they have hearing aids and so on. Those are self-induced problems. I mean, you had to create that condition. You weren't designed or made that way. People have allergies and sicknesses and diseases and cancer and one thing and another. And these evolutionary fools come along and say, well, if we could just have some stem cell research over here, we could cure a disease. Help, every disease has a cause. We can cure disease today. Every disease, all 450 symptoms that are in the physician's desk reference, all of them have a cause, all of them have a cure. Every single one of them. Every single one of them has a prevention. Cancer, there's a cause for cancer, and there's a prevention for cancer, and there's a cure for cancer. In fact, there's 13 cures for cancer. 13. And then every day they come along and they say, wouldn't you like to run and march or do something for cancer research? And the answer is, hell no. You've already got 13 cures to cancer. What in the hell are you going to do with 14, 15, or 16? You're not using the 13 you got now. You don't need me to run around out here raising money to feed a bunch of lazy clowns with white smocks on, doing research on nothing. Let them go out and get a job, for crying out loud. Let them support themselves for a change. It's a wild new idea, I know, but now getting back here, to bridge this gap between the fish and amphibians, the sense of hearing would have to have undergone a radical change. In general, fish receive sound through their bodies, but most toads and frogs have eardrums. Tongues would also have to change. No fish has an extendable tongue, but amphibians such as toads do. Amphibian eyes have to be added, and they have to have the added ability to blink since they have a membrane they pass over their eyeballs, keeping them clean. Strenuous efforts have been made to link the amphibians to some fish ancestor, but without success. The lungfish had been a favorite candidate since, in addition to gills, it has a swim bladder which can be used for breathing when it's temporarily out of the water, says the book The Fishes. It is tempting to think they might have some direct connection with the amphibians which led to the land-living vertebrates, but they don't. They're a separate group entirely, and David Attenborough disqualifies both the lungfish and the coelacanth because the bones of their skulls are so different from those of the first fossil amphibians that the one cannot be derived from the other. Now, this gulf between amphibian and reptile is insurmountable. You know, trying to bridge this gap between amphibians and reptiles poses another serious problem. A most difficult one is the origin of the shelled egg. Creatures prior to reptiles laid their soft, jelly-like eggs in water, where the eggs were fertilized externally. Reptiles are land-based and lay their eggs on land, but the developing embryos inside them must still be in a watery environment. The shelled egg was the answer. But it also required a major change in the process of fertilization. It called for the internal fertilization before the egg is surrounded by a shell. To accomplish this involved new sexual organs, new mating procedures, and new instincts, all of which constitute a vast gulf between amphibians and reptiles. And enclosing the egg in a shell made necessary further remarkable changes in order to make possible the development of a reptile and finally its release from the shell. For example, within the shell there is the need for various membranes and sacs, such as the amnion, which holds in the fluid in which the embryo grows. The reptiles describe another membrane called the allantos. And the allantos receives and stores embryonic waste, serving as a sort of bladder. It also has blood vessels that pick up oxygen that passes through the shell and conducts it to the embryo. Evolution has not accounted for other complex differences involved. Embryos in fish and amphibian eggs release their waste in the surrounding water as soluble urea. But urea within the shelled eggs of reptiles would kill the embryos. And on and on and on it goes, without end. There isn't a single case out of the millions of different types of animals and fish and life forms that we see. Not a single case. Come on, kids. I mean, surely you gotta have one. Don't you? All right, this book is called Life. How did it get here? It's written in layman's language. Dynamite little book. Put out by the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of Pennsylvania. I don't know who sent this to me. Whoever sent it to me, thank you very much. Now I've got the book and I'm reviewing it for you. 18,800,000 copies are out there, so it's not a rare book by any stretch of the imagination. You should be able to get one from any Jehovah's Witness anywhere. Just call the Jehovah's Witnesses and tell them, hey, I'd like to buy that book from you. If you don't want to reveal yourself to the Jehovah's Witnesses, then why don't you go to your local bookstore and ask them if they can get a copy for you. Tell them you want to pay for it. I don't know if it's 5, 10, 20 bucks, whatever it is. But giving credit to where credit's due, it's put out by the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of Pennsylvania. Life, How Did It Get Here? By Evolution or by Creation? Hey, we're about out of time here, children. We're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information, then please call the law school at 417-273-4967, or you can go to our webpage, georgegordon.org. While you're at it, why don't you be sure to ask for our free introductory CD package. Remember that number again, 417-273-4967, or you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.